Anyway, I want to talk with you about this. As Margarita said, I'm co-leader of a really big deal project at Stanford, and we're kind of contend with these deep questions that are arising with biomedical technology. And that's my background in medicine. Early on, I studied at Stanford, and the early hints of the biological revolution were emerging. And so I've been thinking about this my entire professional life. And so, like most things, when you think about it too long, you know, get them too complicated. But what I want to do here is lay out some initial ideas, because what I really would like to do this evening is talk together. And so I'll ramble on for a while here with some broad ideas rather than getting to any final conclusion. And then maybe we can do that together, or at least approximate it in some ways, after my initial comments. So according to the National Intelligence Council report, Global Trends 2030, Alternative Worlds, we're at a crucial juncture in human history, which could lead to widely contrasting futures. Nowhere is this more evident than the promise and peril of advancing biotechnology and the associated applications of information technologies. Together with insights from archaeology, ethology, new perspectives and powers associated with advances in genetics, neurobiology, cognitive psychology, artificial intelligence, and robotics are blurring the boundaries between humans, animals, and machines, and raising conceptual and practical problems of profound importance for the human future. What is the meaning of apparent mind, emotion, and moral awareness in animals? Are humans, as some maintain, just another ordinary animal species? What are we to make of predictions of conscious machines, neuromorphic computers, and robotic servants, caregivers, and companions? Can human nature be reduced to information processing? Are we, as MIT professor Marvin Minsky said, just a meat machine? Will biotech-mediated enhancements of physical and mental powers open new horizons or disrupt fundamental aspects of our humanity? Should we alter human physiology to increase our sensory range, dramatically extend human lifespan, or genetically alter our offspring to enable interplanetary space travel? And what issues of human dignity arise with the creation of human-animal chimeras? That, by the way, is not a photograph. It's a drawing, but it gives you the idea. Human-animal chimeras. Well, we're making them for tissue production or scientific research, and very useful, but they do raise strange questions about how much and what. And what about putting human neurons into rat brains, which has been done? What similar issues arise with human-machine cyborgs, combinations of humans and usually electronic apparatus, brain-computer interfaces, and modular neuroimplants, all of which are on their way? And how are we to regard and relate to our ancestral human species or possible future humans, future forms of human, or maybe even kind of transcended human life? What are we to make of proposals like by the Harvard professor George Church, who's calling for the de-extinction of early hominids such as Neanderthals or Denisovans, or of the transhumanists, their projects for the evolution by design of future humans? That is another thing I got out of sequence here, but that's an organoid, a cerebral organoid made by putting stem cells together, and it self-develops. Back to transhumanists, what are we to make of it? It's a whole growing movement. I'm sure you have some here, but there's quite a few people at Stanford interested in this. They project an evolution by design of future humans. They argue that our advancing genetic and neurotechnologies offer us the opportunity to escape the constraints and cruelties of an amoral evolutionary process, to lift humanity to the next level of personal and social flourishing as human-machine hybrid post-humans. And their symbol is human plus. At the heart of these dilemmas are fundamental intellectual and moral questions regarding the source and significance of human life and our place and purpose within the cosmic order. These challenges distill around three key questions. What are the unique and defining features of human nature? What is the relationship between the given and the good? That is, how does individual and collective flourishing of human life depend on the specific biology of our naturally given embodied form? And in what ways might we enhance or alter human nature without eroding or relinquishing important dimensions of what it means to be human? We can very easily imagine trying to enhance one dimension of our humanity and losing in other dimensions at the same time. And finally, the really profound question, longer term and most perplexing, what role will our technologies and the cultural ideas that guide them play in shaping the human future? In setting the frame for our thinking about these questions, it's essential to recognize the scope and potential impact of advancing biotechnology driven by urgent human problems in agriculture, environmental science, and biomedicine. Global expenditures on research and development in biotechnology has reached over $50 billion a year in 2017 in the U.S. alone. Over 700 biotech companies had a collective annual revenue of $150 billion, a figure that is compounding at the rate of 10% a year. So it's an amazing, amazing thing going on. Building on earlier scientific revolutions in chemistry and physics, we finally arrive now at the more complex level, biology, and the pace and momentum of advances in basic biology and translational biomedicine they're simply staggering. Clearly, we are entering a multi-generational era of unprecedented advances in our ability to intervene at every level of human biology. At the same time, the very theoretical and ideological groundings from which this revolution in biology has emerged have eroded the philosophical and theological foundations of our traditional ideas of human nature, undercutting any hope of easy consensus on normative principles to guide the applications of our new powers. Described in the terms of molecular mechanism and framed within a phylogenetic perspective, modern Homo sapiens is, in the words of E.O. Wilson, a conventional animal species, and, at least in theory, a transitional stage in an ongoing evolutionary process of material refinement and elaboration of the human form. This, in turn, suggests that our given nature is not optimized in some way, but shaped by the constraints and dynamics of an amoral biological process, and therefore may appropriately be open to radical technological revision. Likewise, such a view challenges our notions of distinctive human dignity and ideas of special human rights, leading some to advocate extension of such rights to animals and even to plants, and others to abandon the notion of human dignity altogether. Meanwhile, grounded in the Enlightenment's agenda as masters and possessors of nature, there is a slow but steady shift in the focus of biomedicine away from the traditional role of healing to the notion of liberation from natural constraints. The second century Roman physician Galen said, "The physician is only nature's assistant." But now look where we're standing. We've got, think of all the lifestyle drugs out there, Rogaine, Viagra, and a whole set of them. Many, many more to come. So, slowly but surely, the focus of medicine is turning away from the traditional role of healing to a notion of liberation liberation from everything that's inconvenient, unattractive, things we don't want, to what we do want. Following in the paradigm of cosmetic surgery and driven by individual desires and ambitions, this notion is fostering acceptance of a broader and deeper technological revision of the human species. Moreover, together with a general trend to regard life's challenges as bioengineering problems, there is, at least in the culture of Silicon Valley, a fashionable fascination with ideas of biofluidity, the interchangeability of parts and fluid identities, and an almost religious commitment to utopian ideas of technological transcendence. So at the founding of the Society for Regenerative Medicine, like 15 years ago, William Hazeltine said, point blank, our real goal is to keep people alive forever. So what an amazing moment we're in. So microdosing is in Silicon Valley is an example of this. It's become fashionable and fairly quite widespread for people to take very low doses of LSD every day. So they go to Apple and Google and stuff, and they're more creative. You guys do that at Princeton? I don't know. So it's clearly a strange age, deracinated from our normal moorings for what we're doing and where we're going. In light of this escalating momentum of scientific advance and our shifting cultural assumptions and social attitudes, it seems clear that a fundamental concern must be the clarification of the terms, concepts, and a priori assumptions within which ideas of human nature and human flourishing are established and expressed. Yet as we explore our varied approaches, it's immediately apparent that two radically distinct and seemingly incommensurable terms of description frame our self-understanding. One from the detached and objective in quotes, views of empirical sciences. You know, there is no view from nowhere, but seemingly objective, at least falsifiable views of empirical science. That's one view. And on the other, from our subjective inward experience as sensitive, passionate, and purposeful living beings. The descriptive terms of the physical sciences, matter and energy expressed in the language of mathematics, followed to a large extent by the biological sciences and adapted by the social sciences, are in sharp contrast with the more human-level approaches of phenomenology, aesthetic thought, and personalism, where concepts of mind, beauty, and spirit are often used to reference not just human beings, but to perceived core realities of the cosmos. Which traditions or intuitions should we trust? A good first step would be to openly acknowledge that despite the remarkable advances of our empirical approach, most really, about the science of the human person remains deeply mysterious. But more fundamentally, what is needed is at least in the face of these practical challenges, what's needed is a comprehensive, wisdom-seeking inquiry initiated with the goal of gaining a deeper understanding of human nature and human purpose amid the challenges and opportunities of advancing biotechnology. And here I just want to say something about bioethics. I appreciate the significance of bioethics as a inquiry, but it disturbs me at some level because I think too often bioethics seems like a self-appointed sort of pseudo-priesthood, which where people decide they're the deciders. And in fact, bioethics, to my mind, is not a profession. It's a conversation, and it's a conversation not just with a multidisciplinary attendance, but a conversation for the whole human family. And I can talk more about this later, but I was at the gene editing summit in Hong Kong where the announcement of the germline genetic engineering was announced. I actually know the guy who did it quite well, perhaps better than anybody in America. And it was very stunning because you couldn't help but feel at that moment it was very crisp in sense of significance. You couldn't help but feeling like this was the turning of a corner, a kind of hinge of history for the whole human species, and that the elite educated people should not be the only ones with a voice, but those who do the perennial tasks of having the children, teaching the schools, and doing the work that keeps our civilization going. So just a comment about bioethics. So we need a comprehensive wisdom-seeking inquiry through thoughtful consideration, and this is how it should go in my mind, through thoughtful consideration of how we differ from other animal species and current and foreseeable intelligent machines, we may seek a richer perspective on the biological, social, and spiritual implications of our particular embodied form and inward sense as human beings. Framing our considerations of the practical application of our biomedical technologies with reflections on the difference between humans, animals, and machines provides a helpful heuristic, a kind of conceptual bookends in the story of our nature. Animals, as essentially corporeal beings, basically perception response beings, animals as essentially corporeal beings and machines as abstract information processing devices provide helpful conceptual poles for clarifying the distinguishing characteristics of our species. And it may be that just because I'm from Silicon Valley, I have this sense of the machine, the concerns about thinking of machines, but I want to start by discussing that. I think we all know that it's artificial intelligence and robotics is raising strange and troubling questions. So, moreover, bio and information technologies are not just about us. They're about other beings and other things about which there are social and ethical issues. That's another reason to include animals and machines in our social and ethical reflections. Animals and machines are our laboratory subjects, if you will. You don't normally think of a machine as a laboratory subject, but some tell us we should be. They are laboratory subjects for advances in biomedical technology and artificial intelligence. And at least for now, we do assume that they do not have the essential qualities that endow human beings with a privileged moral standing. However, as outlined below, many of the coming opportunities and challenges in biotechnology will involve ambiguous admixtures of humans and animals, and humans and machines. And sooner than most people realize, the lines between organic and inorganic will become increasingly difficult to draw. There is already a biohybrid robotic device that navigates with optogenetically controlled rat skeletal muscles. So it's coming. Very, very complicated matters are coming. To begin our consideration of the bookends by comparing humans and machines seems at first to be harder. But at least at this point in our technological progress, it's actually far easier. No one denies that humans are animals, or that animals resemble humans in important respects. The question has always been what kind of animal, or how different from other animals are we? But what does it mean if we are machines, or perhaps more disturbingly, if some machines are like us? And what does it mean to say our minds are a technology? A technology like other technologies, in being a set of mechanisms for the routine solution of a class of problems. There is something not quite right here, something smuggled in without our barely noticing it. The human mind is an embodied mind, mysteriously issuing forth from within a living organism, inseparably body and mind, a psychophysical unity. Yes, that is the way we experience ourselves, sometimes feeling like free-floating thought, but then acutely pulled back and aware of our physical frame. And though, since it is a mystery that intuition could be wrong, it does seem that the mind is materially mediated and therefore arises within the minuscule molecular motions that we casually call mechanism, and therefore a technology, if you will, a natural technology. But even if the mind is materially mediated, it is more than a mechanism, since it apprehends and assembles immaterial realities, as immaterial realities that are as real or more real than matter. And anyway, who knows what matter is, actually? That is, the mind is internally operated, not just externally ordered like human-created machines. There is a self there. Qualities of consciousness, including subjectivity and sense of freedom, are present, unlike anything that we think of as mechanism right now, anyway. Machines and logical reasoning may seem similar, mathematical, in their cause and effect relations. But in the human mind, there are other kinds of thinking surrounding, suffusing, and actually deploying the raw computational powers of the mind. Something that was called by Charles Sherrington the enchanted loom. Early in the computer revolution, Stanford psychologist David Rummelhart famously said, "The knowledge is in the connections." Though at the time it was a brilliant insight regarding machine operations and had a big impact on development of computers, nonetheless, taken literally, it cannot be true. There is no knower in a computational device, at least as far as we know. 25 years ago, Terry Winograd, also a professor at Stanford, professor of computer science, and by the way, the mentor for people like Larry Page and all quite a few of the people who started Silicon Valley companies, he doesn't have any trouble getting an endowed chair. So Terry Winograd argued that the human mind is infinite, this is a quote, infinitely the human mind is infinitely more complicated than mathematical logic would allow. Terry's a really nice guy, a really thoughtful guy. He says that the patchwork rationalism that has guided artificial intelligence for 30 years, and he's speaking 25 years ago now, he said the patchwork rationalism that guided AI for the previous 30 years was a misuse of analogy and a wrong-minded approach. He stated plainly, seekers after the glitter of intelligence are misguided in trying to cast it in the base metal of computing. Winograd cautioned that computers are better understood as language machines rather than thinking machines, and noted that human language ultimately depends on tacit understandings, not susceptible to mechanistically determinable mathematical logic. And for the human mind, that term, tacit, as is described in 1958 by Michael Polanyi as personal knowledge, he explains, is something different, not what a computer does. He says we can know more than we can tell. That's what implicit knowledge is. That's what tacit knowledge is. He went on to say that not only is there knowledge that cannot be adequately articulated by verbal means, but also that all knowledge is rooted in such tacit knowledge. And for those of you who know the works of George Lakoff and Mark Johnson and their interesting books like Philosophy in the Flesh, they start to put biology around that intuition, that actually we know the world through our body. Anton Chekhov famously said everything I know, I learned from me, namely his sense of the world. And you stop and you try to ponder what it is and how do we know anything at all. It, according to these lines of thought, requires an organic substrate that at least to have the kind of knowing that human beings have and maybe knowing at all. If one steps back to consider more deeply what is actually going on in the embodied human mind, it's clear it is dramatically unlike machine processing. The organismal self has a distinct human awareness of existential realities, of personal place and purpose within the world, and like every organism, dwells as precarious being, potent but perishable. That's what living beings are. And as with all sentient beings, passionate and purposeful, churning and bubbling within the multiple streams of pleasures and pains, memories, aspirations, hopes and fears. That's what's going on in human thinking. We are thinking about many things at once, and they're all converging. And maybe there's a computer model for this, but I've noticed that every time I think about exactly the same thing, like look at the same picture or even read the same sentence, I have a host of different thoughts. It's not a sort of action-reaction equation. Something vast and proliferating and context-driving is going on. Something that puts every thought within the large frame of all the thought within a human being. This human interpretive frame of tacit knowledge is of the personal autobiographical self. Memory and intention sets the context of every thought. And for most human beings within a culture, this takes place with even more complex overarching concerns and considerations. Within a culture, so therefore embedded in a mythic cosmology of origins and ultimate ends. And though the patchwork rationalism of earlier AI has now been superseded with a deeper and more opaque process of deep mind, machine learning, so forth, at least for now, thinking of machine learning or artificial intelligence as a mind is still a metaphor. And like all metaphors, it carries a limited analogy of similarity in some ways, but not the thing to which it is compared. And that's a big error going on in our society, is the false use of metaphor. The problem is not in the use of the metaphor, but in the overextension and what Richard Lewontin referred to as a process of backward etymology. First, we use a term of familiarity as a tool for understanding, like, wow, that my computer is doing interesting things. It's kind of got a mind of its own. We talk of it that way. But then what happens is we turn around and we reverse the order and use it to describe ourselves. Artificial intelligence may in some ways be mind-like, but that does not make the human mind computer-like. Despite their claims to model or mimic the mind, computer scientists have done no more than create a richly suggestive and culturally resonant metaphor that can help us think about what it means to think. Those who dispense wild speculations about complete uploading of the human mind in silico would do well to reflect on the indispensable role of the organic substrate that supports the functioning of a human consciousness, with all the complexity of personal content and context that implies. And I don't think we've even remotely pondered the role of that organic substrate. There's a lot of good work to be done to illuminate the difference between humans and machines. But now these reflections on tacit knowledge and embodied knowing lead us out of Silicon Valley. They lead us out of Silicon Valley to the marshlands and mountains on either side, directly back to living nature and the mystery of animal minds, and most problematically, the question of what it is that distinguishes the human species from all other living beings. Throughout history, there have been repeated attempts to identify a single distinguishing characteristic that defines human nature and endows a privileged status within the natural and moral order. Or orders, if you don't think nature and morals go together. But whereas previous concepts of human uniqueness were built on direct observations, the featherless biped was one, the animal that blushes was another, and it was also built on theoretical abstractions, individual substance of a rational nature. Whereas previous concepts were direct or abstract, new scientific tools for imaging, probing, and manipulating are allowing deeper penetration into the biomolecular mechanisms, and here I use mechanisms in quote, that underlie species similarities and distinctions. Yet it is notable that throughout this long tradition there was reference to both body and mind. We sense that the human difference and the difference it makes are most deeply distilled in the meaning of minds. Yet the body is there as well. Even the idea of the rational being, as formulated first by Boethius, I guess, was not, as I understand it, some kind of pure mental operation, not ratiocination, but a richer and fuller human experience, as with the Greek concept of logos, which I've been told rational is the language equivalent of logos. And, of course, the animal that blushes, well, that's a direct reference to the human body, but it's also an implicit reference to the mind. But mind, now in its inwardness, not as a mechanism, but its feeling, mind as inwardness, self-conscious, sensitive and socially aware, morally and spiritually alert to the boundaries of self-disclosure, shame, and our personal place within the larger arena of the human story. Mark Twain's quip to the effect that humans are the only species that blushes and the only species that needs to is revealing here, relevant to our reflection on just what might be at the boundaries of humanity, both our difference and our place within the whole. Yet as our scientific understanding has deepened, it's become apparent that even where there are identifiable distinctions, moral emotions, abstract reasoning, and symbolic language, they have deep roots in the origins of life. More and more we've come to question our traditional notions of human uniqueness and come to see ourselves in continuity with our ancestral origins. And this roots us directly into the organic again. And by the way, just so that we all are clear about this, just because we are in continuity with other creatures doesn't mean that we're not different from them. There's sometimes a difference in quantity can be a difference in quality, very important thing to realize. So if we look, for example, at human genomics, it's established an unexpectedly small number of human genes. When I was in medical school, they anticipated there were about 100,000 genes. There's so much that the genes needed to do. But now we're down to around 20,000. A recent paper suggests there are 2,000 less. And we now see that there's extensive homology between our recent and even distant mammalian ancestral species. It's not quite like this, but it's something like we share 98.6% of our genome with chimps and, you know, like a lot with mice and something like 30% of our genes with bananas. But you know, that doesn't mean much. And by the way, the chimp genome is vastly reordered. There's many, many differences. It can't be quantitated like that. So that's an error. Nonetheless, it's very plain that we have ancestral similarities, that we were built of some of the same materials as our primate and mammalian and way back ancestral species. It seems clear that, as Francois Jacob noted 50 years ago, nature is a great tinkerer, and species differences are largely the result of changes in gene regulation, the quantity and chronology of gene expression. If we go back in search of the source of this difference between us and those who share our common raw materials, how this is built on shared foundations, we can see, at least within the lineage of human origins, a trajectory of ascent to an ever greater range of adaptability, responsive in understanding and and responsivity and understanding and control. First in the vital powers of awareness and action, motility, and then in the dramatic extensions of organic being made possible through mind. As Antonio Damasio has rightly said, the mind had to be first about the body, or it could not have been. That's an evolutionary perspective, of course. And again, he rightly identifies emotion as the foundations for feelings, functional, purposeful feelings, used in establishing the organic infrastructure of the ascent of mind. He believes that feelings are essential to the establishment of body maps, which then establish the image from which we can understand the difference between ourselves and the world. And later, those images become imagination, a very, very crucial component in human difference. Building on ever more responsive adaptations through mutation, in the beginning mutation, then cellular modularizations, and then multicellular specializations, then refined powers of motility and perception, together with emotions as the foundation for feelings, we've gone through the phylogeny of the organic infrastructure for the emergence of the human mind, and most specifically, the valence emotions of appetite or desire, the organic emerging from the participatory self. I want to show you something here, if I can get it to work. So this is a white blood cell chasing a bacteria, it's what happens in the bloodstream. And this is just a single cell, but watch how purposeful it seems. Anyway, you get it? It really looks like he's going after it on purpose. And I guess I don't have the part, but eventually he grabs it and eats it. There he goes. Oh, boy. So, see, I said he. So you can almost feel like there's intentionality and qualities of mind operating. That is probably reasonably described as organic mechanism. Nonetheless, with the emergence in the process of being with feelings, something happens where there is a distilled and efficacious self emerges. And it's a very hard and complex thing to figure out what exactly is going on and how it ends up as the human mind. I saw this sign in a lab at Stanford of one of my friends, and he'd spent his postdoc years doing monkey studies. And whereas for a lot of human history, they somehow just didn't think of animals as minds. I don't know, maybe Descartes worked a transition, but obviously for the last 100 years or so, people have been taking very seriously the notion of animal minds. And we've gotten to the point where we really anthropomorphize animals very profoundly. And so we've tipped in that direction. But I went down into the lab and I saw this sign and I thought it was quite interesting. Never overestimate the mind of a monkey. And so, but yet you look into those eyes and you feel there's a mind there. And you wonder, how is that different from the human mind? And of course, Beatrice Potter, she made it hard not to think of animals as just our little friends with fur. And I love those stories and read them to my children, and they're very compelling. Well, so this is Coco the gorilla. And Coco lives in the town that I, or lived, she died a few months ago. Coco lived up the hill, just a couple miles from me. And Penny Patterson, that's Penny in the picture there. Penny invited me up to meet Coco, and I spent a whole afternoon watching Coco and talking with Coco. And I was really just jazzed to do that. I thought that was really going to be cool. And I have to tell you, Coco was like human beings in some ways. Coco really liked pizza, for example, and got fed pizza, which I think was wrong. But Coco was very unlike a human being, in my mind. You know, Coco had interesting things. More than anything, Coco wanted to see the gold fillings in my mouth and kept kind of going like that. I had to keep my mouth open. Coco was fascinated by that. But I didn't feel the presence of a being that was like a human being at all. There was something else going on, something quite a bit below the level of what I consider a human being. I would obviously care to take concern for Coco as a similar creature, but something was not quite there. As mentioned earlier, by its very nature, animal life is precarious life, facing outward in space and forward in time and engaged in self-directed, purposeful behavior, aiming toward the fulfillment of its needs. Prefigured in primary homeostatic mechanisms, which are the basis of emotions, body regulation, cross-phylogeny, this inner sense of lack was gradually transformed into the subjective experience of emotions, embodied feelings, and then into the appetitive drives that align, motivate, and empower sustained effort in the fulfillment of need. So you can picture organic processes, not just being reflexive, but there's now a mind in the loop, a feeling mind. Desire, by at once encoding value and bridging across time to the fulfillment of a goal, greatly increases the realm and reach of an organism's operation within the world. Even at its most primary level, there is a strange ontological inversion over all things non-living. Notwithstanding some current ideas of evolutionary biology of our origins, like Dawkins' idea of robot vehicles, there is something more going on. With a computer, there is no there. The opposite is going on with animals. In an earlier century, Darwin had commented that the final end of the flower is the production of the seed. But John Ruskin, the foremost art critic of the Victorian era, objected. The flower exists for its own sake, not for the fruit's sake, Ruskin said. And though these controversies eventually undercut Ruskin's religious convictions, he was right. Ask any organism. It is one of the paradoxes of life. Well, let me start that quote earlier in it. Hans Jonas, very worthwhile reading, The Phenomenon of Life. Hans Jonas says, speaking now of organic existence, it's not duration as such, but duration of what is the question. This is to say that such means of survival as perception and emotion are never to be judged as means merely, but also as qualities of the life to be preserved and therefore as aspects of the end. See what a reversal that is of robot vehicles or organisms just as gene transition devices. Qualities of life to be preserved and therefore as aspects of the end. Jonas goes on to say it is one of the paradoxes of life that it employs means which modify the end and become parts of it, and themselves become part of it. The feeling animal strives to preserve itself as a feeling, not just a metabolizing entity. It strives to continue the very activity of feeling. In the words of Leon Cass, desire, not DNA, is the deepest principle of life. I think I'm going to just stop right there, because that gives us the raw materials now for talking together about the challenges of biotechnology and what's going on here. What'd you say?
We have 30 minutes.
Okay. So, just one thing I might have added, and I wish I had the quote up. There's this writer, popular writer, Yuval Noah Harari. How many people have read his book, Sapiens or Homo Deus? I mean, he's a very fluid and graceful writer, for sure. But I'm uncomfortable with what he says. But one thing I do agree with him about, that desire is going to have a lot to say about what happens in the age of biotechnology. And he even says, This is a quote I wish I'd put up now. He says, we're going to want what we want, and we might even want to change what we want, which is a very interesting comment and proposal. So let's talk together about this. Yeah. Do it really loud.
Okay, I can be pretty loud. So given that the germline modification trials are due within the next 6 months to begin in China, where Western civilization doesn't really get to comment on the ethics of it until the experiment is done, we just hope that they have some sort of massive safety failure, like the gene editing trials in the 90s, so that no one wants to go near it again? Or how do we make ourselves a part of that conversation since the train has left the station?
Yeah. Well, that's a really, really relevant question right now. And the global community is actively seeking the answer. Let me back up and tell you what I know about this. I'm the co-leader of a project with Jennifer Doudna, who discovered CRISPR-Cas9. We're doing a project together on deliberation of the social and ethical issues and a kind of education and outreach to engage the public. And as I said about bioethics generally, this is about the gene pool. This is not about even individuals' choice to do something to themselves. This is about the future of our species. And more than anywhere, this needs to be a collective conversation and requires engagement before it goes forward. So Jennifer and I organized a meeting 3 years ago last month. And just let me take a moment and tell you about this. We got a grant from the Templeton Foundation, and it took a long time to get it, and we wanted to meet in January. So we got it in November, and we thought, we'll make a list of 30 people, and we'll get who we can. We'll go into the next 30 and get who we can. We'll get the best scientists we can get and talk about what's coming scientifically, and then we're going to do the same thing ethically and outreach in subsequent meetings. So we made a list of 15 scientists, world-famous people, and sent the emails out, and boom, in 24 hours, they all said yes, they would come. And the reason I'm telling you that is because that, more than anything, underscored for me the meaning that scientists who really knew what was happening with CRISPR-Cas9 recognized how significant the ethical deliberation is on this. I'm pretty sure that 15 of the top scientists in the world just didn't happen to have those days open, but they came. Well, in addition to that, a young scientist nicknamed JK, that's He Zhongkui, who you know from the papers, was coming through, and somebody, I think maybe Jennifer, suggested that we invite him to see what he's doing. And so we gave him 15 minutes, and he presented some of his stuff like everybody else. And there were comments and criticisms and sort of back and forth, but it was just like a young scientist working on the foundational principles that would have to be done, doing the basic hard work of figuring out how to do this, if it should ever be done. And then I talked with JK a little during the conference. He was an amiable kind of guy, and he was only 32 years old. And a few months later, I got an email from him saying, I'm coming through Stanford, could we meet up? So I said, yeah, let's meet for lunch. Unfortunately, I had nothing to do in my calendar, so I started talking with him, and it was fascinating talking with him. Not only was it interesting hearing his actual science, but I was starting to get the sense of what's going on in China, and particularly where he's working in Shenzhen. Have you guys heard the phrase Shenzhen speed? Well, Shenzhen is the high-tech center of operations in China. And just 40 years ago, it was a sleepy fishing village. Today, it's just absolutely booming place. It's like Silicon Valley on steroids. And, of course, what's happening is everybody's under huge pressure, and everybody's excited, and everybody's just caught up in the technological advances and the conquest of whatever it is that they're trying to work toward, mostly good purposes. Well, J.K. was very clearly in that realm, and as I listened to him, I started to realize this guy does not have the foundation for thinking about what he's doing, that he didn't have any really basic perspective on the social implications or the ethical governance of this sort of thing. So I just started taking the time to familiarize him with some of this stuff, and then subsequently he came back several different times and talked with me. And one time, we were talking, just a year ago exactly, he almost to the date, and I was clear he was moving forward more, but I still didn't believe clinically. I was getting kind of worried. I spent the entire afternoon with him, and we started talking. He was telling me how important it was to push forward with this stuff because there's so much suffering. And I said, yes, but it's not simple as that. Suffering is a very important equation and ethical consideration, but it isn't the ultimate trump card. The argument from suffering has no bottom. You can always go deeper with that argument. You have to contextualize suffering and other things in the larger human good that's going on, and that's true of all of our technologies, by the way. So we were talking about it, and then I said, and by the way, there's suffering in nature, yes, but there's also beauty, and there's a mystery going on into how nature is constructed, that we have to be very careful about what we're doing with nature, not just not to disrupt its operations, but because there's something more going on than operations. There seems to be a meaning within nature. And so I said, it's like the redwood trees in my backyard. And I live in a beautiful place behind Stanford, and I have a creek and a redwood grove in my backyard. I can't believe it. It's so beautiful. But the only explanation I can give for why I have it is because God knew I would enjoy it. But so I said, redwood trees are so beautiful. And he was looked blank, and I thought, why, he doesn't even know what a redwood tree is. I said, J.K., have you ever seen a redwood tree? He said, nope. I said, you were at Stanford as a postdoc for a year and you never saw a redwood tree, because they're only like 5 minutes behind Stanford. And he said, I never went a mile west of Stanford, which is such a tragedy. He spent his whole time in the lab. This is a hard working, dedicated guy and a very nice person. And so I said, come on, JK, I'm going to take you out. And we took a walk in the redwood trees, and he just loved it. It was sort of like he was seeing something he'd never kind of expected could be real. And afterwards, he wrote me about how he felt, and it was beautiful. And in that conversation, I got more and more worried, though. I spent the entire afternoon, I got more worried that he was fast-forwarding with his work. And at one point, I even said to him, you know, J.K., there's wisdom in the collective operation of human beings, and something that exceeds us individually, and that, if there's any one thing that's an argument for democracy, it's that. And then I started telling him about the Gettysburg Address, and I said, quoted the line, of the people, for the people, by the people. Is that how it goes? And I actually even sent him the Gettysburg Address. I don't know what the Chinese authorities monitoring his email thought of that, but he was stirred by it. And I thought, I've got to intervene before he makes a mistake. I've got to convince him that he needs to stay in coordination with the global community and the dialogue on this. And then I didn't see him for 6 months. And he came to see me in October, and he said, I have an important publication coming out in a few months. And I said, what is it? What is it, JK? He wouldn't tell me, because he said, I can't tell you. It's in publication. I can't reveal it. And besides that, the Associated Press has been there filming about it. And I thought, uh-oh. But I still wasn't sure. It could have just been right on the edge of clinical studies. But I suspected strongly. And I said, well, what's Associated Press doing there? Because it sounds like fame and fortune, like it's been spun in the journalist accounts. He said, no, that's not why. It's because I don't speak good enough English, and I know I'm going to get grilled on this. I know I'm going to have to explain what I'm doing. I thought, even more, oh no. But I do believe him, that he was an earnest guy trying to do good, well-meaning guy. And then he was not planning to reveal this until after the International Gene Summit. As you may or may not realize, there originally was a gene summit in 2015 put forward by Jennifer Doudna and several Nobel laureates and stuff, and they realized that germline gene editing is a very serious issue. So they had this one, they issued a statement about what needed to go slow and needed public engagement. And then they scheduled another one for Hong Kong in November 2018. And on the very eve of the summit, the 2 hours before I landed in Hong Kong, the publication came out from a very clever investigative journalist who figured out that he'd done germline genetic engineering and got to the hotel, and it was just buzzing. And he was scheduled to speak the second day. The first day, things went on as normal, but nobody was talking about anything but germline genetic engineering. By the second day, JK, who was supposed to have just 7 minutes to do his stuff, was given an hour and a half. And by then, reporters from all over the world had arrived. And they dedicated a third of this huge auditorium, maybe say 1,000 people, and a third of it was journalists, you know, telephoto lenses that were 4 feet long. And by that time he needed a security guard. The Chinese press had originally said neutral or nice things about it, but as soon as the American and European top scientists started criticizing it, the Chinese press turned. Well, why did they turn? Why did the Americans criticize it so strongly? Well, it was a huge embarrassment to the conference. The conference was intended to both get people together, but also to show that the scientific community globally can govern this stuff. And this was like, exhibit A, we can't govern ourselves. So that just gives you some background. When JK stepped to the forum to give his talk, it was like the most silent silence I've ever heard. It was incredible. And then when he got into photo position, the click started, and it was so loud that the moderator had to come forward and say, no more pictures. JK was actually quite poised. I don't think he realized yet what was going to fall on him completely. But it was not well received. And as you probably know from the journalistic accounts, he's in big trouble now. I'm so worried about it. He's called me from Shenzhen now. Quite a few times, and we've talked 2 or 3 hours each time, and I've been trying to say positive things in the press, at least about his intentions, because I'm so afraid that they're going to give him a severe penalty. And if that happens, it's partly because worldwide everybody wanted to run for the exits. He was not the only. He did not do this in a corner. Many people knew about it, and It's a tragedy, both personally, and it's a tragedy internationally. I guess I didn't really answer your question. That gives you when he stepped to the podium to speak, it was, I felt like I was at the epicenter of the human story. I knew we'd turned a corner in human history for the first time in nearly 4 billion years. A creature was on the scene that could rework its evolutionary future. It was like a hinge of history. It was literally like the epicenter of the human drama. And I think that's what it is. It's going to take time to ramp up, but we're never going backwards on it now. Yeah. Sorry, that was a very long answer.
Can you hear me? I'm just interested in answering the basic ethical question, on what grounds can we intervene in nature and when can we not? And listening to your talk, I sort of heard moments of Aristotelian teleology.
Yeah.
Just understanding the purpose and the intentionality of the meaning of basic biological functions and being nature's assistant. That classical model seemed to be what I was hearing from you.
Yeah.
I guess I'm wondering, is that the school you're coming from? Is that the only school we have? Are there any other philosophical
fountains
that we can pull from to limit the work of science, or is it really just back to Aristotle?
So you're hearing the overtones very well. I really don't know how to answer your question properly, except to say this. When I was appointed to the President's Council on Bioethics, I had personally become against abortion during my medical school years. I saw an abortion. It was an amazing moment. A doctor who knew I was thinking about these things took me on a suction abortion, which was illegal. It was labeled as a tumor. And it was a suction abortion. The parts come out, and he, I don't mean to be graphic, but he actually went into the filter jar, blocked me from seeing it with the water faucet, came over and plunked into my palm the little tiny trunk of the fetus. The arms, legs, and head had been ripped off, but I could see the little tiny spine, the little ribs, the pelvis. It was a little female fetus. And I'm pretty tough when it comes to medicine. I'm very kind of calm and objective. I don't faint with blood and stuff. Tears started rolling out of my eyes. And I was not ideologically committed at that moment. I even got in an argument of sorts with my physician father when I went back after my first semester of medical school. And I said to him, so what's wrong with abortion? It saves a lot of pain for people. And he said he wasn't religious, and he wasn't even that sort of thoughtful about ethical matters. But he turned to me and he said, Bill, we're healers, not killers. And it had a big impact on me. When I saw it, it came back to me in a rivetingly real way. And I felt, but that was a developed fetus. And there were arguments for why early embryos might be in a different status. You know, the UK has such arguments, 14 days. So when I was appointed to the council, as you guys probably remember, anybody over about 25 remembers, it was a very tense issue whether we should be using human embryos in research. And your own faculty member here, Robbie George, and I became really good friends, and Robbie talked with me deeply and about the Catholic tradition in these matters. And I was brought up, as I said, not in a religious family. I was forced to go to Sunday school, which I disliked, and I only became a Christian when I was an undergraduate at Stanford. And then, even then, I didn't, and even when I was appointed to the council, I didn't really have clear core convictions on matters of teleology and the relationship between nature and the good. And thinking about the embryo issue brought me more and more toward Catholic tradition, and specifically, I mean, there is no utterly endorsed singular philosophical tradition, Catholicism, but Thomistic thought is probably the prominent formulative theme. And I realized that in the human embryo, there was an existing, I don't know quite what the right words would be here, but a potency, an actuality that was just unfolding, that if you just gave it time, it would become itself. And then I started to realize in biology, the whole precedes and produces the parts. It's not like something on a manufacturing line, that there's an implicit principle of life that develops itself. And I backed out of anything I had by way of ambiguity and became convinced that we should not be doing not be using embryos instrumentally. So yes, I think reflected in my thoughts on that, and probably all through what I said today, is an implicit teleology. But if you go back into the line of thinking that's dominated through the 20th century, all these casual, quick thoughts about, you know, denigrating the so-called naturalistic fallacy, and all this stuff, it goes all the way back to Hume, I guess. But, you know, E.O. Wilson said it fine. E.O. Wilson, you know, he's an atheist, I guess, or maybe partly not, but he's allergic to religion from his Southern background. But E.O. Wilson very plainly said about 5 or 6 or 8 years ago, if you can't look to nature for the good, where are you going to look for it? You're just going to pull it out of your mind, thin air? No, I think we have to have some reference to the natural world, and not in a rigid way, but a hinting, at least. I want to put a couple of quotes up that I have in my PowerPoint just to show you something. That's a good one right there, but this is what I was after. I almost put this up in my presentation, but Thomas Cole, as you probably know, was really the founder of the Hudson River School, a wonderful artist, down in the National Gallery. His four pictures of this, I don't remember what they're called, the Stages of Life, are very, very famous, iconic American paintings. But look at that top quote, and look what Mill had to say about it. And strangely, I agree with both of these positions at a level, but I think Mill is right on the bottom one. And I have to say, I mean, if to draw a final conclusion from my perspective, not that we have to end right now, but if I were ending right now, I would say, yes, we are co-creators with the Creator himself. Mysteriously given, and that summarizes what the human difference is between animals and machines. The human being is a mysterious intelligence within an intelligible order of being. So I've served on the Templeton Foundation for years as a trustee, currently serving as a steering committee member for the Templeton Religion Trust. But I remember the first day I met John Templeton, and I'll tell you this because I know he has a very deep connection to Princeton Seminary. So I had never met him, and I was invited to a board meeting, and John Templeton came in after everybody was assembled, and it was a very distinguished group of people, including, I don't know, 6 or 8 Nobel laureates and about 60 people. He came in when everybody was assembled. He sat down at the table, and he looked out at us, and he said, "I love you. You are the pioneers of the future of humanity." And then he talked at some length about how earnestly we needed to take the engagement of technology and spirituality, that our advances in technology beckoned us forward to serious spiritual reflection on their meaning. And then at one point, and I was sitting next to the vice president of programs, and at one point he leaned forward and he said, "Can't you, great, brilliant ladies and gentlemen, can't you invent a machine that can detect love?" And I kind of elbowed Chuck Harper sitting next to me, and I said, "There is one. It's called a human being." So what is it that we're doing with our technology? We are strangely, as the Niels Bohr quote said, we are mysteriously spectators and actors in the great drama of existence. John Templeton loved that quote. But how do we do it? How do we know what to do? You know, I just plain don't have a simple answer. What my answer is, we find the deepest currents of life in the search that goes beyond that sort of reductionistic and analytical mode of thinking. We go to the quest that a human being should go on. We're, after all, Homo sapiens, the searchers for wisdom. We go on that search, and for me, that search ended unbelievable, given my background. It ended with convictions as a Christian. And ultimately, although I'm not formally converted to Catholicism, I'm more nourished by Catholicism than any other tradition right now. But partly I'm not converted because I don't feel like I want to be distanced from any of my brothers and sisters in Christ. But I do believe in general grace, but I do believe in the central doctrines of Christianity, the incarnation and the redemption and the resurrection. I have very good scientific training, and I still believe in the resurrection, and I got to believe in the resurrection while I was on my pathology clerkship doing autopsies, and not because I was scared, but because I believed. One afternoon I'd go see the patients, the next morning one or more of them would be on the autopsy table, and I realized, it can't be. Either it is, and it's horrible, the work of some kind of demon god, or much more positively, when God gives the gift of life, he gives it forever. Those are my convictions. And I think it is aligning with those principles that we are infused with the Holy Spirit, and the Holy Spirit will guide us through our technology. I really have no other answer. Essentially, I retreat, or go forward, if you will, to the point that C.S. Lewis got to when asked about something or other. And he said, we should answer all of our problems with more love, not less love. So that's where I'm at.
Embryos don't seem to
Yeah, that's so. There are two ways people approach the question of embryo moral status. One is that there are expressed features that we associate, manifest features that we associate with human dignity, and that would be something to do with mind for sure. I wouldn't want to be, you know, harsh or crude about this, but frankly, I don't think a human tissue growing without a head is a human being. That doesn't mean you deal with, and there are such cases in embryogenesis. That doesn't mean you're disrespectful to it, but you don't treat it as a human being. But that's one tradition, it's a very dangerous position because who gets to say when it's there? And the other tradition is that if those powers are present but latent, not yet expressed, that there's a kind of, you guys probably have better words for this, but it's not exactly potential. As has been said, human beings are not human embryos are not, how does the phrase go? It's not potential human beings, but human beings with potential. And that summarizes the difference. One view says that you're human when you've manifested potential. The other says you are human when you have it, and yet, even if it isn't yet expressed, if it's on its way. I mean, after all, that's what embryos do. The word embryo comes from a Greek word meaning to grow outward. It's that's what an embryo is. It carries in itself the intrinsic powers of its own development. The fertilization is a leap, morally speaking, it's a leap from zero to everything, in my opinion. It's the leap by the, you know, the individual gametes, sperm and the egg, are not, they're to be respected, but they're not living organisms. The organism starts with the joining of the sperm and the egg. And from my way of thinking, if you want to talk with me and correct me on this, I'm open to hearing it. But in my mind, once you make that leap to organismal status, you've got a human being in process, a unique and unrepeatable gift of life. Is that okay?
Well, please join me in thanking our guest.